Apollo Solari's city is designed in the image of man, an efficient complex in one complete miniature package, a completely functional form, just like our bodies. Today we live in the city in the image of the car, a city in fragments connected by asphalt arteries. Solari's city, an arcology he calls it, would gather and assemble those fragments.
If you considered how we perform in our daily lives, you see that the performance demands only about 10 feet in height, while it demands very large areas horizontally. So when you try to connect those areas horizontally, you get in troubles. When you try to connect them vertically, because you're able to pile them up, then you see immediately how swift the connection becomes. Not only that, but there is something peculiar about the difference between the car behavior mode and the elevator mode. The car needs the road. The road becomes a divider, a separating element. It becomes a segregative element. The elevator is able to do the same thing better, much faster and economically without separating, because it perforates through the performance instead of separating them, cutting into them and separating them. So I really think that the answer, the instrumental answer and the logistical answer to the problem of the cities is a congruence between the horizontal dimensions and the vertical dimensions.
Solari has already begun one such city, Arcasante, an arcology designed for several thousand people, presently being built up near Cortis Junction. If man can accept Arcasante and other arcologies, if we can live there, Paulo Solari hopes we will then be on the road to spirituality, an obscure idea in a world where economics and politics have nothing to do with justice, and more importantly, where people's relationships have little to do with who they really are. In Solari's book, The Bridge Between Matter and Spirit is Matter Becoming Spirit, he writes, "We are what we make of our environment. A heartless and pauper environment does nothing more than reflect and denounce the harshness and indigent condition of our minds and souls. To change all this will require greater things than wealth and determination. It will require a definite moving away from materialism, determinism, and arrogance. It will require a truly reverent attitude toward the sacramentality of all things." Last week I talked to Paulo Solari at Cosanti, his home and workshop in Paradise Valley. I got there a little early, so I spent some time just wandering around, watching people and looking at models of arcologies. I found Solari in one back workshop, dressed light in the heat, with a frame like Gandhi. It was there that we sat and talked for a while. Solari seems like a quiet man. He calls himself withdrawn, but he's not spare with his words. He speaks softly and distractedly, as if he might be wasting his time, elaborating his ideas over the roar of the workshop fan and the voices of the workers at Cosante.
I've been reading your book the last couple of days, wandering around here. In your book, you talk a lot about...
Is that the little one? Or the
new one?
Yeah.
You talk a lot about complexity and miniaturization being married. And wandering around here, I get the feeling of simplicity.
Well, yeah, this is not what we are after.
Uh-huh.
This is what we are.
Even looking at the designs of Arcasante, you have eliminated a lot of the needs that we find in the city, and that to me is simplicity. So I must have misinterpreted what you meant by complexity.
No, I don't think so. Complexity doesn't mean necessarily gadgets, which are very complicated. Complexity is mainly a relationship affair, a mental affair. So you don't need necessarily a very complicated machinery to reach a complex environment. What makes for the complex environment is the responsiveness of what you make to the needs of the life that develops there. In a way, the non purely rational aspects of this environment. And we can take examples. You saw the models there,
mm-hmm.
where any one of the structure that we have now
though they might look simple, they are capable of serving individuals and groups and society in many different ways. So they have the ability to be very apt for different needs and activities.
A lot of people today don't seem too willing to accept the prospect of living in urban concentrations in the future. They're sick of and sick from the city we have now.
Yeah, well, they never were allowed to really enjoy the city as it could be, mm-hmm. especially in this country.
They see virtues in other environments, like a small village setup that, in your book, you describe as kind of sterile when you're describing the farms. They see virtues in that as far as the community and the camaraderie between the people.
Yeah, but it's a very elementary camaraderie. That's why simplicity doesn't fit my vision of what reality is. Uh-huh. It's a nostalgic moving back to something that is irretrievable. Fortunately, so, because life has to move, keep moving and evolve. It cannot stop and then put the reverse gear and then move back.
You call it an elementary camaraderie, but it seems to me to be in some ways linked up with what you call environmental knowledge, which not knowledge stored in the mind, but more in the heart or whatever.
Yeah, the trouble is that that environmental knowledge, it's in a way only one kind, which is the kind, in a sense, that preceded the advent of the mind, what we call the natural kind. So that if your children are growing up in that kind of environment, to me they are deprived of whatever civilization, for good and evil, has been able to come up with for the mind of man. So it's an oversimplified solution for a problem which is tremendously complex.
What specifically are they deprived of? You mentioned art.
They are deprived of all the intermediary elements that we tend to call institutions that are going for the communication and for the process of learning, which is part of civilization. And to put names on them, you can say the theater, the library, the discotheque, church, all the things that necessitate a certain critical temperature in order to develop, to have substance, and to be afforded. So the little village might have a little library that cannot have a substantial library. It might have a wind instrument complex of a few people playing a guitar or a flute and so on, but cannot have what you might call a great sound resource. And if you look at what those institutions do, you might realize that that's part and parcel of the nature of man at this point.
You talk about two kinds of knowledge, environmental and synthetic. Could you give me a description of that?
Yeah, the synthetic knowledge, well, it's not even knowledge, it's information. The information that you are going to transmit from this interview is going to be of the synthetic kind, which means unknown voice is going to come up with a number of sentences which are probably out of context in very little, so that this interview is going to be in very little. The environmental knowledge, taking the same people involved, would be for the viewer or the listener to come, for instance, and work here or better there, and get involved in the process of developing things which are only remotely discussed here or in the book.
Your book, would you call that? would you call the information in there environmental or synthetic?
No, it's again synthetic, because it goes directly from the page into the brain. And it just happened that the media is the eye, but could be the ear, instead of reading, you would listen to a record. Whenever we have a short circuit that goes from a data into the brain, you have a remote information. So all the electronic information is remote.
Is it then very useful in our lives?
It's tremendously important, and it's tremendously dangerous because of this remoteness and because of the very special sharpness that it might have when it deals with a very narrow band of any aspect of life.
It's synthetic knowledge then that has led us to where we are in danger.
It's the unbalancing more and more of this synthetic knowledge non-balanced by the environmental information. Now, the environmental information is not only the village or the wilderness. The environmental information is the wilderness, the village, the town, the city, the living room, and so on.
You also talk about form and function, and how form precedes function. You give an illustration of the giraffe. Mm. How you grew a long neck and learn to use it to survive. Arcasati is based on that, in that you would build it, and then people would go through a spiritualization as they lived in it.
No, that's only part of it. I think it's in the same paper. I'm saying that the city is to be the place where the two kinds of conditions are satisfied. One is the satisfaction of functions which we know of in the bathroom, in the kitchen, you need a garage, you need a laundry place, you need a police station or whatever. Those are known entities of the city. So the design of the city better cater to those necessities. At the same time, that's not the neck of the giraffe which is developing without apparent meaning. The meaning is going to come out later on. So while you design the city in functional terms, you have to keep very present in your mind or in the mind of the team that is going to design it, that there are elements which are not clear, they're not rational, they're not logical, they're mysterious, and they are theological or magic or whatever you want to call them. And those are the elements that are going to make or break the city.
Do you expect men to see those elements before they pick up an idea like Arcasati?
Well, in any activity, the elements of the unexplainable is present. So it's not that what I do has that character and nothing else has. But when you're dealing with a comprehensive problem like the environment, that element has to come in. And how can you get it in? It depends on the substance of the minds that are in the back of it. Because you cannot pinpoint it, you cannot program it. You just have to somehow approach the problem of the city with a frame of mind which accept the reverential ethos or the reverential condition that the mind has to be in when it does things.
In our present situation, living in a city like Phoenix, we seem to have lost ourselves to the point where we really don't understand our pain and the suffering that we're going through. We're kind of numb to it. And so an idea like Arcasati is, we can't see it clearly. It doesn't bring forth what it brings forth for you. For men in the city, they're so involved in it, so involved in their own suffering for so long, that Arcasati isn't what it is to you.
Yeah, the suffering is self-inflicted. and self-inflicted by the stubbornness of man to be practical. So little by little we answer to our problems or of distress or fear, frustration with what we call very practical solutions, and we add up this mountain of practical solutions which are utterly unreal.
Do you think
so that the structure of Phoenix is an unreal response to very real challenges?
But no one seems to be seeing that they're going totally in the wrong direction. They seem to be coming up with more solutions to their situation.
The proof is in the pudding.
Uh-huh. You act like you expect man to come around more through coercion than reverence.
No, through coercion of reality. There's no way about it. There's not two ways about it. Reality, it's a very stern and demanding reality.
Do you think that eventually we'll come to the solution which you've reached? You outline a few alternatives we have, robot-like lives.
Well, that's to be seen. See, if I had a solution, I would say, yes, men will come around it. I don't have a solution. I have a methodology. The methodology has to be implemented, which means between the methodology, which is some kind of a guideline, and the application of it, there is quite a bit of struggle.
Since function comes after form, you can't be sure.
Okay. Yeah, only as I was saying, as the part or whatever the problem is, which is transcendental, which means it doesn't have the answer into the causes. The cause is something, the effect transcends the cause.
Okay, I might not be understanding your answer,
yeah.
But I'll say what I was going to say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If function does come after form in the case that you say, then you can't be sure that man will become a more spiritual creature, more in tune to the universe after he moves into Arkasaka.
That's right. Just because it's there are no real guidelines or rationalization about this let's say this mystery, we don't know if we are succeeding or not. So most of the time we do not succeed, but that's part of the toughness of life.
Is there any way you can make more certain that things will succeed?
You can make it more certain by trying to be true to what you feel the important things are, and try to preach a little, but also to live a little.
We go through a lot of loneliness in the city. The city seems to, at least in my case, it seems to numb me to individual people. So many pass through my life in one single day, and so many seem to want something of me, and I do the same. I want something of them, that I become very numb and distant to them. And that contributes to my self-image of myself, which also contributes to my loneliness and everything. I always looked on that as the product of being in any place where there was a large number of people. And Arkasate will be a place where there are a large number of people in a miniaturization.
Mm-hmm.
More concentrated than they are now in Phoenix, and that leads me to a quandary.
I think it might help you into this quandary if you try to understand what life seems to be about. And you see immediately is that life is cooperation, getting together, interaction, working out problem that seem to be insurmountable, and so on. And this is not something that has been going on only in the last few generations. It's been going on for about 3,000 millions of years. So it's a substantial teaching that we have there. If you take away this aspect, which is cooperation and interaction, you destroy life. It's automatic. So if there is something which is very clear, is the matter, in order to be sensitized, to become sub matter or spirit or mental stuff or conscience or compassion or anything like that, has to follow that path.
Have you intellectualized how a change will come about in Arkasani, or is that again part of the transcendental area that can be verbalized? How?
Well, you can see immediately the functional aspects. You can see that for the same size of population, for the same thing that this population can do and has available, Arkasanti is going to be a far smaller bureaucratic machine, a far smaller garbage collection machine, a far smaller postal delivery machine, a far smaller market place machine, and so on. So that means that it's going to be able to do much more with much less.
Mm-hmm. What in the area of environmental knowledge or information, as well as what you describe as accumulated to things that we've come up with in the history of man, things like books and art and other things, also included is the rest of the universe, correct? Mm-hmm. Nature. How will we be better in tune with that part of environmental information once in Arkasanti?
By being true to the true trust of life, which is to become more knowledgeable, understanding, and hopefully wise to it, so that we can work with it.
It will be more of a state of mind than a physical.
Oh no! It deals very much with the physical aspects of the whole system, because we are not, by far, we are not pure spirits. So our spirit is conditioned to our physical being. So the psychosomatic man has to be totally considered. But to be true to nature, as we call it, is to be true to something which usually we don't really mean when we say nature.
When speaking of Arkasanti and that the transcendental changes, the spiritualization we will go through.
Hopefully, you have to always keep that in mind.
That's right. You talk about pain and loneliness and the loss of it down to what you describe as residual suffering, which you say is compassion is born of that as well as joy.
Yeah. I would say that the most important resultant is creation, which I call it aesthetogenesis.
Then you'll have to define creation as differentiated from compassion and joy.
Compassion comes somehow from the perception that whatever we call life or reality is something, as I was saying before, very demanding. And in this demanding process, lots of suffering is involved. Joy might be called somehow the other facet, though life is a very demanding thing. Just because it is so demanding, it's able to exhilarate people or beings in some instances, and those are very often, most of the time, are very short instances. So joy, it's a burst of liveliness, and then you go back to a certain evenness of feeling and perception. The aesthetic process, it's somehow the making use of those elements to create something.
Making use of compassion and joy?
Yeah.
Okay. So
which are part of the anguish.
As far as a valid aesthetic process, the only valid one could be is the one born of compassion.
Yeah, the difference, I think, between the beauty that we call the natural beauty and the beauty that man is able to create now and then is that this second one is a compassionate beauty. is the equivalent in human terms of the beauty of nature coming before mankind.
As it stands now in our situation in the city, what do you see art as? Born of compassion?
No, it's just an extravagant, or maybe a result of fear or frustration or ennui, what do you call it, boredom and so on. There is very little, I think, of what I call aesthetic happening in this age and in this time of ours. We are very much inclined, even when we think we do, we work around aesthetics, inclining and producing tools for something that we don't know what's going to be yet. So we are really the instrumentalization at this point of a next step. Unfortunately, we don't know what the next step is. We don't even care about it. So we, in that sense, we become instruments ourselves because we lack the impetus or the trust or the belief or the hope that something better can come about.
Art Gassade is your creation, at least the framework of it, since, from what I understand, it's a combination of spontaneity and planning. But the framework is planning and your creation.
I make a distinction there. I would call it an invention. Hopefully there'll be something more than that. But that's again, is the long neck that is not granted.
Can we say that that invention is the product of compassion?
Hopefully,
yeah.
But I make a distinction between compassion and pity or piousness. Compassion is not necessarily the act of the pious person. It might be something quite different. In a way, it's on a scale which hopefully tries to encompass more elements than what the act of pity, of piousness might entail.
In your life, did the function come after the form? Did you?
In many instances, yes.
How did you conceive of, say, Art Gassade?
Well, even in Art Gassade, I had somehow certain directions which were given to me by the methodology, let's say, which is the discovery. At the same time, by nature, because of my nature, or I came up with what you might call forms, which are not totally and absolutely justifiable by that methodology. So I might come up with something very extravagant if I fail. I might come up with something pretty good if I don't fail.
You talk about the last period since the Industrial Revolution up to this time being a period of preparation for what is to come.
Mm-hmm.
Then you also say that this vision of Art Gassade and this vision of man without sadness and only with the residual suffering is something that will come after generations.
I'm not sure I got that.
Okay, I'm just trying to say that the vision of man as a joyful, compassionate being,
yeah,
with everything, losing all his suffering, but that residual suffering will come after generations.
Yeah, there are kinds of sufferings that are not, in a way, are superfluous. In other words, we torment ourselves to a length which is not necessary, probably. At the same time, one of the drawbacks of this civilization is this pursuit of happiness. If we pursue happiness, it's definitely we are never going to get anywhere. We are not going to be joyful. Because the pursuit of happiness is like a grinding, effort. I'm going to be happy. Well, that doesn't make any sense. You have to try to be worthy, and then if you're worthy, you'll get some moment of joy.
Okay.
But they're going to be drowned almost in other in what I might call the anguish, which is you cannot get rid of, because it's part of the nature of life. Life is a very fragile, very isolated, very tenuous phenomenon at this point.
It's somehow comforting to know, I guess it rises out of any compassion I feel, that someday the human race will be free of all the things it seems to put itself through now. But in my lifetime, it's not going to be. And I feel that I need to be, but I'm still surrounded by ideas that have built cities like Phoenix, by automobiles, by food, by crummy food, by ownership, by all those ideas.
Yeah, well, I could say I got news for you, but I don't know. I don't want to mean that I know better, but it's not that your generation is not going to get it. We are not going to get it for possibly thousands or millions of generations. We must put ourselves in a perspective of history.
I just have to believe that I can do it in my own lifetime, and any man can do it.
No, I think you have to believe that what your behavior and what you're going to do of your life is going to be a little speck, a little brick, building this creature, which I call the Omega God. So if you cannot believe that, and if you cannot take your anguish and try to make use in those terms, then you're going to be frustrated no matter what's going to happen. I mean, you're going to feel that you're wasting your life. But you're not wasting your life. Your life, I mean, you can, but your life is an infinitesimal parcel of something much bigger, much greater, and much more powerful. But this thing is in the making. It's not there for the taking. Has not been given to us in the past. Doesn't exist there outside of ourselves. It's us making it, us from the virus up to man. Trans man, etc.
I admit to being confused, but when you talk about the transition from matter to spirit, it's an idea that I've heard so much about lately, or in the past few years, you know, just because I've directed myself in that area, that I'm familiar with it, but not really in comprehension of it. And that fools me.
Maybe you should try to see spirit not as as a perfect, utterly beautiful, utterly everything, but consider the origin of the spirit, what spirit might have been at the beginning. Then you see that at the beginning spirit was a kind of very vague and very dumb and dull perception of what things were around you. And I mean by this not you when you were conceived or so, but the conception of life itself, the beginning of life. As soon as matter or mass energy for some reason broke away from the deterministic or the reductionistic structure of the universe, spirit was born. So if you can conceive that, this very dim consciousness, as the first manifestation of spirit, then maybe, and then you try to follow it almost cinematically through the evolution of life, then the fact that now spirit is still a very, in a sense, very limited and dull and unwise and full of holes and unexplainable thing, I think you can accept possibly your condition and the condition of any other person and the condition of any animal, the condition of any plant and so on. But if we say spirit is everything and has always been there and now, and we are just trying to go back to that perfection, then I think we are in for total disillusionment and for a breakdown of our minds.
I like to talk about Arcasante on a practical basis just for a little while. You talk about the idea of Arkasanta bringing about an entire political and economic change. How can, once Arkasanta is completed and functioning, how can it exist in a nation where we're still adhering to the old ideas of politics
and economics? Well, the hope is not that it would exist on a steady state environment. The hope is that it would be a trigger or the match that lights the A-fire. If it doesn't do that, it might be just an enclave of elite people or privileged people or lost people that are trying to survive and make it until they die.
Once people are...
So I see it as a dynamic point which might help to change not just the life in that point, but the life around it in wider and wider circles.
Once people are in Arkasanta, the setup as far as labor goes will be different from what we find it now, is it not?
Well, that would be very much in the hands of the people. I don't legislate.
There are jobs.
I'm trying to define an environment.
There are jobs you describe in the book as not so nice jobs, I think you put them.
Oh, well, yeah, but I think that I was trying to suggest very strongly that we should not live in the illusion that we are going to get rid of all toils and all sorts of routines and so on. In fact, I said that routine can be made into grace so that we can enjoy even the humblest kind of activities that we are engaged in.
One of the not-so-nice jobs you mentioned was police work, and that implies more than toil and routine. A policeman has to have something. There's another person involved in that job, a criminal or something.
Yeah. Well, there is... I think there are aspects in the police work which are not enjoyable. When you have to resort to violence, for instance, I don't think that's enjoyable. So if you can have a society that might do with less violence, and including mental violence, then the police work might be transformed into a doctoring or who knows what, nursing or who knows what.
Politically, how will things be administered?
There again, you have to ask the people that are going to be there. We are beginning now to have those things coming up.
Uh-huh. It's something you don't want to share your thoughts. You must have had some thoughts.
Well, it's first of all, I'm not that knowledgeable about politics. But politics is an instrument. So if we establish those things a priori, then evidently we think that man has to be fundamentally a political animal or fundamentally an economic animal. That's not true. Man is fundamentally a religious or a creative animal.
By saying you're not knowledgeable of politics, you're implying that people who know about politics will then decide what goes on in Arkasanta, and the people who know about politics out here don't know about
That's part of being able to integrate the remote information with the environmental information. And if you can define an environment which is strong enough to really engage people in that kind of information understanding, then possibly the political mind might gear itself to a larger chunk of reality, which is what it was not what's happening now. The political animal is a very abstract animal. And the best example is what we did with Vietnam. If there is a clear-cut indication of what the synthetic mind, a very bright mind, can come up as far as distortion of reality is, to see what the McNamara and Rostov and the Bundys were able to concoct in Asia. A fantastic twist. Maybe they should have been asked to do some physical work not like the Chinese do. Yeah. Every 6 months or so, and be involved with people that do that kind of work for their life. Then maybe they would begin to understand what the Vietnamese person is.
Is there anything going on in the world now that you would see as something that can be incorporated in Arcasante on that basis, political or economic?
Well, I wish I knew more about China. You know, I know so little what's happening there. I wish I knew more about Israel, what's happening there, and what happens in this country, in many communities or so. I would never dream of saying that everything that is around now is bad or irrelevant. I would say that what we have is very precious. We just have to try to be more discriminative. So I'm not for destroying, or for a sterile critic. I think I have some right to criticize because I think I can offer alternatives.
Is there any historical precedence for something like Arcasante? And more than that, is in looking back over the path man has taken in recorded history, do you see that he's gone the wrong way completely and that's what's led him to where he is now?
I think when the technological thing exploded because of the ability we had to latch on energy and produce instruments that could use energy by the bulk, we went haywire, yes.
That was the dangerous synthetic knowledge.
That's right, and the exhilaration of power that comes from having power available. So the intelligence of man works for the spirit and works also against the spirit. That's why we have to be very careful when we get into using technology.
Children's having fun. All these silent flashing lights. there was a feeling of I was some crazy guy in the desert digging holes. Now I'm a crazy guy with some crazy theories, but those theories are becoming accepted. So the people start to read about and listen. Once we get something going on in terms of bricks or mortar or concrete, then we come and look, and then at that point someone might decide that there's something very positive there. We are finding out that affluence is not such a blessing. And we're finding out that it's not such a blessing because affluence tends to desensitize more than what we were expecting. So instead of making people more sensitive to environment, to other people, to the institutions that we have invented, we see that people tends to withdraw or just to enjoy what we call the comfort of a certain environment and ignore things which are far very, very important.
Such as?
Such as the ability to seek new things, to not to be satisfied of what there is, the ability to enjoy things of a more subtle quality, which means in general that we tend to halt or to reverse the process of life, which is the going from matter into spirit.